brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Oathsworn and Burrows and Badgers, when I got back into the hobby a few years ago, they were one of the first miniature ranges that I came across. You know, when I had that revelationary discovery that there was life outside the Games Workshop.
And,
you know, they immediately caught my eye. They've always been one of my favourite miniature ranges since then. So, I mean, we're looking online there, we're talking 10 years now since the first Kickstarter, aren't we?
Yeah. It was a bit of a gamble, really. I mean, I've been working as a freelance sculptor for many years. And we wanted to do something for ourselves. We started out with doing some dwarves and bits and pieces. But other work I'd been doing had been kind of animal related sculpting. I've been doing stuff for various giftware companies, things like that, where I did a lot of horses and stuff. And so one of the customers just said, "Oh, you really ought to try and do some anthropomorphic animals sculpts. You know, you'll probably be good at it." So we thought, "Oh, I'll give it a go." And just knocked a few up and put them online. And people were like, "Oh, yeah, they look good. We'll probably buy those." So I did the first set, basically. And we did a little Kickstarter for it. And I kind of assumed that would be it. And we wouldn't do any more afterwards. But obviously, it took off from there.
Yeah, I mean, were you surprised at the reception you got when, you know, you put them out there for the first time?
Yes, very much so. I think one of the main issues we had after that was that people wanted to know what they were going to use them for. That was the obvious question. It's like, what do we play with these? It's previously we'd done dwarves, we'd done halflings, stuff like that. Everyone knows what you do with that. You put them in your Warhammer army or play a bit of D&D, whatever you like. With these, people were kind of unsure what they were going to use them for, which obviously led on to me having to try and make some rules, which was the next step, really. So once we'd done the second Kickstarter and we had about 40-odd miniatures in the range, I had to kind of knock up some rules to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a different skill set as well, isn't it? Like, you've created miniatures and then you've gone and written rules, which are published, and you know, it's a very popular game. I believe there's a second edition coming out in April. Did I see that right?
Yep. It should be released at Salute. Fingers crossed. We're still waiting for delivery from the production people, but it should be ready for Salute.
So was the early iteration of the rules, was that your first attempt at writing a game?
Kind of. It was, I'd always, you know, it's like wargamers, we're always tinkering with stuff, aren't we? You're never happy with a rule set, anything you play, and you always come up with house rules and you change bits. And so I've been doing that, and I'd come up with a couple of rule sets that we'd just been using ourselves for kind of medieval battles, things like that. And I kind of developed Burrows and Badgers from one of those and just changed it. The key change was that was a 2d6 plus skills system. This one we switched to using the polyhedral dice because I thought it suited the range of different animals better. So that was the key change. But other than that, it was really a development of stuff I'd already been working on, which was handy because that saves a lot of time.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, a lot of folks out there, myself included, are also using the miniatures in miniature agnostic games. Like you presumably find a lot of folks were like Frostgrave Warbands or
Frostgrave Warbands, yeah.
Yeah. So talk to us a bit about how the company works, like who else is involved?
It's just me and my wife, Jo. There's just the two of us, and we're in an industrial unit on our local industrial estate, and we just pretty much do everything.
So are you both sculptors then?
No, just me. Jo's into art, but not... She doesn't like sculpting. She does like wood engraving, and she does all kinds of things. But just me for sculpting.
Yeah. And how did you kind of get into the sculpting initially?
I used to work retail for Games Workshop many years back. You know, it's like you've been messing around with miniatures for a long time. You end up doing conversions and things, doing head swaps. And I mean, this is going back before plastics, really. So, you know, when they were metal, you used to have to cut the heads off with a pair of tin snips or whatever and try and drill and plug a new head on or whatever. And from that, you start getting a bit of green stuff, you start adding pouches, adding cloaks, things like that. So I kind of gradually developed from converting And then just being out of work and having to come up with something basically to make some money, I just thought, right, I'll just start practicing sculpting. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of sat down and got on with it.
How different is your process today than it was like in those early days?
I don't think it's different at all, to be honest. It's the same, you know, the same basic bend up an armature, bit of brass wire, and start slapping the putty on. Really, I've got a I've got aphantasia, which means I can't visualize things in my head. I can't see pictures in my head. That's a bit of a pain with it because it means that I don't have an idea for how the thing's going to look when it's finished.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of rough it out in advance with a quick sketch or two, but I don't really know. I kind of have to make it up as I'm going along. So yeah, they don't always work. Sometimes I'll get partway through and realize this isn't going to be castable, or, you know, it's just not looking right, and I have to throw them away and start again. But the basic process is just start with an armature, get a rough idea, and start sculpting.
One of the common sort of praises or compliments of your miniature range is just how clean they are. Like they really are like flawlessly clean. Is that kind of something that you pay particular attention to?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you're sculpting, you try and get them so they'll cast as well as possible. One of the problems we have is that everything, it's kind of been a range that a lot of new people to the hobby have got into. They've seen it at various shows. We were at the UK Games Expo a few years back, and so obviously we saw a lot of new people there, didn't really know about miniatures. So to keep it kind of friendly for new people coming into the hobby, we've tried to make them all one piece wherever possible. The advantage, obviously, that there's less cleanup, there's less, you don't have to put them together, it's easier to get them on the table. The downside is that it makes it harder to get good mold life out of them, get good castings out of them, because you've obviously got a fair few undercuts and things when you're going with a one-piece figure. So I have to look carefully at that, and then I do get a bit carried away on the quality control anyway and end up sort of cleaning them up here before I send them out anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Talk to us a wee bit about a typical day then in your life.
We get up, we come here, and mornings pretty much is orders, because our local post office, they're just a couple of old people, and they don't have any other staff, so they're only in. We have to get all the orders into them by about 1 o'clock, because they lock up at 2 and go home, because they've been in since 5. So we spend the morning getting all the orders ready as much as we can so we can get them out for 1 o'clock. Afternoons, generally speaking, I'm doing either paperwork or casting.
With the orders then, just talking about that for a minute, like is it fairly consistent, the amount of orders that you've got coming through a company like yourselves, or is there a sort of ebb and flow or a seasonal kind of variation for that?
You always get a bit. There's always, like, obviously, you know, November time coming up for Christmas, there's always more, and January, February, there's always less, but that's kind of it really. Sometimes you'll get less during, if it's really hot, summer months, August time, but it's not consistent. I mean, generally speaking, you get more when people are in doing hobby, so, you know, dark nights, people aren't going out, you'll get more orders, but it's not enough to kind of really change the way you do business.
Do you get much hobbying done outside of the work then?
Not really. It's basically taken over completely. My hobby now is buying other people's miniatures and stacking them up on a shelf behind me.
Yeah.
I've got boxes and boxes of stuff waiting to go. I mean, I wanted to get into Kill Team because I liked the idea of Kill Team, but I've got the last 3 editions of Kill Team sat unopened behind me. I bought each one and just added it to the pile. So I don't even know if it's any good as a game now. I've been, you know, one day I'll open one, hopefully, get something built.
Do you like the modern aesthetic of the Games Workshop stuff?
I mostly, when I do build stuff, I mean, very rare occasions I get something done. I like 3rd edition 40K. That's kind of more or less where I stopped getting extra 40K stuff. I like a lot of the new sculpts, but I tend to use them in a 3rd edition army because I just thought the game worked well then. it was a proper game. There wasn't the kind of the collectible card mechanics that you've got in the modern version, really. It just felt like it was a better game. So even now, if I do get time to do anything hobby related, I try and fit it into an old third edition kind of project, because I know I'm very rarely going to get around to putting anything on the table anyway. So I might as well indulge myself.
You ever converted one of your own miniatures into like a 40k character or that?
I haven't, no.
Have you seen many examples of people converting your miniatures out there?
Yeah, there's a fair few. Obviously, we've got the Burrows and Badgers Facebook group. There's a lot of people in that, and you do see conversions in there. There's been some pretty cool stuff. Just modern them up. We want to grow the range and cover all the bases, cover all the options. At the minute, people have to, you kind of, if you want bow-armed certain figures, then if I haven't got one in the range, people tend to convert them, that kind of thing. But it's not a what you see is what you get game anyway, so it doesn't really matter that much. But people do enjoy converting them, despite the downsides of converting metal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How often are you releasing brand new figures?
It varies massively. I try and get a Kickstarter done once a year. Try and get releases for Salute. But my sculpting time is very limited. I tend to just get it on an evening, on a weekend. Even then, if I'm like at the minute, we're prepping for Salute, so a lot of my evenings and weekends are taken up doing things for that instead. So my sculpting time is just so limited that I just get what I can done when I can.
So Kickstarter's obviously been really useful to you over the years. Is it something you've consistently used for the past decade?
Yeah, it is an odd one, the Kickstarter. We've got certain customers who won't use Kickstarter. Fair enough, they only want to get stuff from the web store. But we've also got other customers who won't use a web store and will only get stuff from Kickstarter. And the same with trade shows. You've got some customers that will only get stuff from a trade show. They won't order it from your web store. They won't get it through Kickstarter, which is odd, but you know, everyone's different. So you kind of have to use all the options, basically.
Aside from the Burrows and Badgers range, I've seen the, is it Sensible Shoes as well? Is that a separate range that
we
that you
did
do?
Have that? Yeah, I've stopped selling them basically because I just don't have time at the minute to keep up with it all. Mm-hmm. So Burrows and Badgers has basically taken over completely at the minute.
Yeah,
we've done various things. I mean, I've got loads of other stuff planned that I want to get on with once I get some time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd really like to do some sci-fi because sci-fi has always been a bit of a, you know, bit of an interest of mine.
Yeah, have you ever done it before?
Yeah, we've done a bit. We did it right at the beginning, just when I was coming from being freelance to sculpting for ourselves. I did a bit of a sci-fi range then. We did a Kickstarter for some sci-fi robots. I've not done a lot of it. I'm hoping this year I'll get some time. I'm tempted to have a crack at doing some digital sculpting, because I've not tried that before. I thought I'd give it a go, and I'll probably use that as an excuse to mess around with a bit of sci-fi stuff.
Mm. What was the premise behind Sensible Shoes when you were doing that range?
It was literally at the time D&D 5th was just coming out, and there weren't that many basic female character miniatures. So we did, the first range was all female characters, basically. You're going through each of the classes, low-level characters, doing them as women.
Mm-hmm.
It filled a niche at the time. Obviously, there's a lot more available nowadays, which is good. So it's there's less need for it. But it did well at the time.
I read an interview with you just in the lead up to this conversation on, it was Goonhammer.com. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you were saying in there that because a lot of people, myself included, you know, grew up reading the Redwall books, Brian Jacks, and as you were saying there, there was no influence as far as I know that, you know, when you put this range together, it wasn't like it was because it was an homage to that series, was it?
No, I mean, I know the guy who suggested it to me was into them, because he liked them. My mate, I mean, when we first looked at doing Anthros, I contacted the Redwall estate and said, you know, is there any possibility of doing something miniatures related linked to this? But they've never got back to me, mm-hmm. which, to be fair, suited me fine, because I didn't really know much about it, but having looked into it, they don't have any, there's no magic involved. You know, they're kind of delineated into certain animals are good guys and certain animals are bad guys, and it didn't really fit with what I'd want to do with the background anyway. Mm-hmm. So probably just as well.
You mentioned wanting for Games Workshop back in the day. So was that retail? Were you wanting in one of the stores?
Oh, yeah, just stores.
Yeah, and what sort of year was that?
Ended in 90. I was there until 99. Mm. So Mordheim release was the last thing we did.
Yeah.
In the Middlesbrough store, yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, no, it was all right. Yeah, I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, it's still a retail job. So you've still got targets to meet and all the rest of it. But then what I'm doing now, while technically I'm designing games and sculpting miniatures, I'm spending most of my time doing VAT returns and all the day to day stuff.
Yeah. I just spoke to Curtis at Ramshackle the other week there, and we had a bit of a chat about VAT and the EU and it's all
GPSR
the stuff that
and all that. Yeah.
Kind of joking about when you grow up and have a dream of running a company like this, these aren't the tasks that probably are top of mind, but a necessary part of running a business, I guess.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Have you ever, because I guess there's a couple of different ways to look at running a company, whether it's in the hobby or not, and one is to just stay small and the other is to try and grow and expand. Have you ever thought about making the company bigger, hiring extra help or whatever?
One of the two problems with making it bigger, really, firstly, is that I'm a bit of a control freak anyway. I like to do everything myself. I'm never thrilled when someone else is doing it because I feel like I want to watch over the shoulder the whole time. So that would be difficult. But the other thing is you kind of need to, you want to do it in a sudden jump. If you're just taking on one or two staff, you've suddenly got all the extra costs involved. You've got your employer's liability. You've got to do PAYE. There's a lot of stuff comes with employing just one person. If you're employing 10 people, then it's cost effective because it's the same hassle to get 10 as it is to get one. But when there's only one of you, I don't know. I don't know. I've thought about it, but at the minute, I'm kind of happy as I am. But on the other hand, we're kind of at breaking point for the amount of hours I'm putting in. So we'll see.
Do you do 5 days a week, 7 days a week? How does your week look?
It's pretty much nonstop, to be honest. We're in the workshop at least 5 days a week. But when I'm at home, I take stuff home with me to do. So,
mm-hmm. Do you find it challenging to switch off?
Yes, but then that's the same whatever I'm doing, really. It's I'm not good at downtime because it just feels like you're wasting time.
Mm-hmm. So if it's you and your wife running the business, how does it work if you wanted to do a couple of weeks holiday somewhere?
We generally manage it once a year. We tend to claim, but we just basically close the web shop for a fortnight and just don't take any orders because we're both the same in that if orders come in, we need to get them done and get them shipped.
Yeah,
and I can't stand having things hanging over. So, yeah. But we tend to close up sort of once a year and take a couple of weeks off. Occasionally we'll take a week off, but that's usually if I've got a supplement to write or something, and we'll take a week off and I'll go and sit and write that instead. But it is difficult. It is difficult, but I guess it's one of the problems of this kind of business.
You mentioned Salute. How many events and conventions do you try and do per year?
We used to do a lot, far less now, again, just for the time, really. This year, we're doing Salute. That's what we're focusing on because hopefully it's going to be the release of the game, the new start of Warbands, things like that. And normally we'd be at Vapnartak and Hammerhead. This year, it's not really worked out because we've had family problems with various members of our extended family being ill and having hospital treatment and things, and we've had to be available for them. So that's kind of scuppered the early shows. So we've got Salute booked in. I don't know how the rest of the year will shape up yet. We'll just have to see.
What are the biggest benefits you find from going to these events?
I think it's as much as anything, it's that people expect you to be there. I'd say you meet new people. You at some of them you meet new people. You get exposed to new people, people who haven't seen you, because it is often a different crowd. It is often people that you're not seeing through, you know, on the internet, in your various sites and things. So you do meet some new people. Other than that, it's just people like to see you and speak to you, basically. And, you know, it's good to catch up now and again.
Outside, I know that you don't get the opportunity to do a massive amount of hobbying, but are there any other miniature companies out there that you're particularly fond of their ranges?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on my pile behind me, I've got obviously the usual Games Workshop stuff. I've got Strontium Dog, the Warlord put out. They haven't opened either. I bought a load of miniatures for that. I like that. I just like the idea of Strontium Dog, and I liked the sound of the mechanics for the game. And who knows, maybe one day I'll play it. Other than that, I've got Gangs of Rome and Baron's War from Footsore. There's some great stuff in that. But there's all sorts. You know what it's like? When you're into the hobby, you're just... I've bought bits of pretty much everything. I've got Ancients for Hail Caesar and Early Imperial Romans for that, and a bit of Greek as well. And I've got piles of the stuff.
Do you keep in touch with any other sculptors, any other companies, any other rules writers or whatever?
Online, you know, there's generally a bit of chat back and forth with other people and other manufacturers too. There's various Facebook groups we're in where we just kind of keep each other up to date on what's going on. It's at the end of the day, it's a fairly small niche hobby, and you do kind of know everyone.
Going back to, you know, the origins of your hobby, like how did you kind of get into it in childhood?
Finding Citadel miniatures in a store when I was 10. Warhammer First Edition had just come out that year, and they had. Well, I picked up some Fantasy Tribe orcs from the local toy shop, and never played First Edition Warhammer because it didn't make any sense to me. But I was buying miniatures anyway and painting them with Humroll enamels, and then started playing with second edition Warhammer when it came out the following year, and just kind of went from there.
What were some of your favourite miniatures growing up? Can you remember?
The Perrys doing their basically dwarfs and orcs. It was basically dwarfs and orcs. And I just, any of the Citadel dwarves, any of the Citadel orcs, I just, you know, especially early stuff before they got slaughter bases.
So you're saying you didn't really play, it was more about the collecting and painting?
It's the inevitable problem when you're a 10-year-old kid, getting enough figures to do an army is a bit of a challenge, especially back then, because they're all metal and you needed decent-sized armies for it. We did a fair bit of role-playing as well, because we could get away with smaller numbers of figures for that, just get some dungeon floor plans and, you know, a bit of D&D and what have you. And then just gradually built up to do the wargaming.
Did you have any gaming pals at school?
Yeah, I mean, it was more or less at the time when Brian Ansell was just gearing up to buy Games Workshop off Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson, and he needed to raise £1 million in 1 year, and so they just pumped out tons and tons of figures, and so they were everywhere at that point. They were in all the toy stores. They were just putting them out everywhere. So for about a year and a half, everyone at school, all the lads, were buying them. So for that first year, at least, there was a lot of people at school that were into it.
What sort of games were circulating at that period then?
It was mostly role-playing stuff, but first edition Warhammer, there was obviously standard D&D, Tunnels and Trolls, and then we got MERP, Middle-Earth role-playing, and that was big at school for a while as well, because people were into Lord of the Rings. And it was mostly role-playing stuff. There weren't that many wargamers. Bit of historical, but not much.
Did you continue to do the hobby, or did you have a period away from it and sort of adolescence or early adulthood?
Yeah, no, I carried straight on. I didn't really let things get in the way. Just always been into it. So yeah, it was kind of constant since I was 10. So all through, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like if you're, when you're, something is your interest, you just, that's kind of what you're thinking about all the time. So,
How did you get your job at Games Workshop? Was that just like they had an opening and you applied for it?
Yeah,
sort of thing?
It was just a part-time thing to start with. They just had an opening for a key timer, part-timer at the Darlington store had opened pretty recently, and they did a key timer. So I went down, did the interview, got the job, and then went full-time after a couple of months, and then went to manage the Middlesbrough store, and then came back for a bit to manage the Darlington store.
What were your favourite sort of roles or memories of that job? Were you kind of teaching folk to play games or painting with them? Or
honestly, we used to do Thursday night. We'd do a staff night for gaming, and that was the best bit, because you actually got, you know, you had a requirement to do some gaming, which was great because it meant you had to get on and do it. So forced you to get on and play. So we'd do Battlefleet Gothic or Mordheim or whatever, and that was great fun.
Did you feel a bit of pressure when you were managing that shop? You know, ultimately there's sales targets and that. How did that kind of impact?
Oh yeah,
you?
I mean, there was always that. It was I can't even remember what the guy's name was. There was a guy who was the area manager at the time, who was a bit of a pain because he'd come in from supermarket retail, didn't really get the hobby. He didn't last long, but for a while he was there. It was all about sales targets and your window display. He wanted you just to pile up a pyramid of boxes of 40K rather than having miniatures in the window and things like that. So you kind of got to deal with, that's just part of a job, isn't it? You just deal with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So looking ahead to coming back to now, like we've got this second edition of Bottles and Badgers on the horizon. How do you tackle the second edition of a game? How much work is involved in seeing what you're going to keep, what you're going to add, what you're going to remove, and all that?
It's a lot more challenging, I'd say, than writing a first edition. When you're writing a first edition, there's no expectations. Nobody knows what you're going to release, so you're just writing it, and then you put it out there and see what people think. When you're doing a second edition, you've got an existing audience, and that makes it a lot more complicated because you don't want to upset people. You don't want to lose gamers, but you also want to attract new gamers and you want to provide them with new content, things like that. What we did was we set up a playtesting group on Facebook because we'd done that with the first edition as well, and it was pretty good. It gets you a wider range of people, if you like. You can do playtesting with a local group, and that's great, but you're only going to see the same faces. They're familiar with your stuff. You need to kind of get it out to people who have no idea of who you are, how you write, and then they'll look at it with no preconceived notions. And if it has to make sense to them. If they don't understand it, you're not there to explain it to them. So it's handy having that. What we did initially, I did a draft PDF and put it out there of what the game would look like if we addressed all the complaints that people had. The various, over the past few years, people had said, oh, didn't want to get into the game because it was too reliant on modifiers, or there was a various list of things that people had said, oh, if you change this, oh, if we could have more characters in, if there was less customization of the characters. So I wrote basically, okay, this is a stripped back version of the rules. This is how it would look if we did all those, if we met all those challenges. And inevitably, the current players didn't like it, as I knew they wouldn't, because it changed pretty much everything. And I was like, fine, let's move from there. We did a version 2, which brought us closer to the original version of the rules. Version 3 brought us even closer. Basically, what we did was gradually got back to the rule book exactly as it is, but just fixing, just tidying things up, adding new content. But you've got to give people the chance to see how it would be if the things they wanted you to change actually happened. Otherwise, they come in and they don't want you to make any changes, or they think they've got a great idea. So, we made it basically the most altered version we could, and then stepped back from that several times until we got to where we are now.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's a lot of lines to toe as well. you know, it might be welcome to get feedback from somebody about something that they don't think is quite right or not working very well, but you don't necessarily want, with all due respect, you don't necessarily want that person to then suggest an alternative. Like, you don't want them to start writing the game for you.
No, that's ill. It's always useful to get outside perspectives just on how occasionally you get a good idea. Somebody will come up with something and you think, yeah, that can work. And it does occasionally make things better. Overall, you've got to be a bit careful, because oftentimes people will just say, no, I don't like that. But you need them to explain what it is they don't like, because you can't change something until you know what the actual problem is. And sometimes they're just wrong and you just have to ignore them. You do get some people who will just say, no, I don't like this. Everyone else likes it, so you've kind of got to go with it.
Yeah, yeah. How do you manage the playtesting in terms of the ability to solicit feedback and channel it in a sustainable way, rather than, you know, I get this huge message for this person sends me a video, like, is there a way you kind of try and direct
it? Like? Mostly through the Facebook group. Mostly I'd ask a question, I'd say, okay, this is what we're looking at now, this is how it stands, this is how it works, you know, give me your feedback on that. Then we put it into the rule set and we try, get people to try it. You still get the people sending you voicemails, some people sending you videos, some people send you emails. You still get all that. And I haven't found a good way to manage it. You just have to kind of work through it all.
So with the second edition, what sort of things could players expect to see?
Well, with the new edition, I think the main thing we've done is we've kind of simplified various bits that people were iffy on before, like the hiding and the ambushing. A lot of questions about hiding and ambushing. It was a bit too complicated, so we've simplified that kind of thing. And other than that, it's mostly new content we've added. The books, I mean, it's well over twice as thick as it was. We used to have sort of four allegiances you could choose from for your band. Now we've got 10. There was like 30-odd spells. Now there's like 90. We've got way more content, basically. We've upped the number of scenarios up to 20 now. So there's just a lot more in there, basically. We added a lot of stuff experimentally through... We did a thing called the Oathsworn Journal, where it was just PDFs with trial rules for people to test out. And they've been kind of working on that. We've taken the bits that worked, dumped the bits that didn't, and put all the stuff that worked into the new rules. So it's basically similar to the original version, but there's a lot more to it. We've streamlined it and simplified certain bits to make it easier. But overall, I think it's just there's a lot more content to get your teeth into. So if it's a game you've played before, then there'll be a lot of new stuff to learn, a lot of new stuff to get to grips with. And if you're new to it, it'll just be a pretty much all-encompassing campaign game, really. I'm really looking forward to it, I must admit.
How did the game get picked up by Osprey initially?
I'd written a kind of basic paperback version myself, the first version of the rules. We released it at Salute that year. It must have been about 2014, I think, something like that. And then a couple of months later, we were at the UK Games Expo, and Phil Smith from Osprey wandered by the stand and he bought a copy. And then he obviously looked at it in his hotel room on the night, and he came back the next day and just said, you know, would we like him to publish a hardback version of the rules? So I said, yes, please.
What was it like putting a book like that together? Was there a lot of photography in that to sort out and background stuff to write?
Yeah, not a huge amount of background stuff, because at that point I hadn't really done any. So my first version, it was very simple little paperback. I didn't know much about getting stuff printed. So we were like losing 85 pence on every one we sold, I think, because I'd got them printed, but I hadn't got many printed. So you don't get a cheap deal if you're not getting many printed. So we were effectively using them just to try and get people interested in the miniatures. Moving on to the Osprey version, I didn't have to do the art. Thankfully, they get someone in to do the art for you. Layout they do for you, which obviously is, you know, it's a mixed blessing at the end of the day, because they don't necessarily lay things out the way you'd lay them out. But on the other hand, you get the benefits of being published by a big company. Photography-wise, I assume it's the same for everyone, but Osprey like you to do the photos, send them in. So I did all my photography myself. With the first version, we were still working from home at that point. So I basically had to just kind of tip the bed out the way and try and set up a camera balanced on some books and set a load of miniatures up in the corner of the room and just do the best I could. A lot easier this time around because we've got the workshop here now, so at least I can set up a proper table to do the photos.
Cryo Volcano, a solo scenario that could be played with any sci-fi skirmish rule set and miniatures, is now available on the Bedroom Battlefields Patreon. It was originally published in Miniature Wargames magazine, and you'll now find everything you need to play it, along with a whole host of additional bonus content, over at patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. That's patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. And now, back to the show. How important is having that community around a game like this?
I think that's one of the biggest things you need to do as a company. I think what you'll find with a lot of games is that they come and go. And the reason they come and go is because there's not the commitment to support the community from the maker. It gets annoying sometimes when you're answering the same rules questions again for the 50th time in the Facebook group. But equally, people want things answered. They want that kind of feedback. They want to know what whether they're doing it right, whether they're doing it wrong. So while it's a lot of work keeping it going, you've got to support your games. If you support your games, they'll grow. And I think that's what we've done with Burrows and Bad. There's been so many other games I want to do. I've got various bits half written. I've got sci-fi stuff. I've got fantasy stuff. I've got a bit of historical all ready that I want to get on with. But Burrows and Badgers, because people want to play it and they buy the miniatures, we need to keep supporting it and producing new content, producing new miniatures and giving them answers to the questions. And all that helps build your community. It keeps your game going. I think as a result, you get people who maybe looked at it a couple of years ago or saw it when it first came out and they thought, yeah, maybe I'll give that a look. Those people then see it in 3 or 4 years' time. They see that it's still around and then they join in and you get new customers, you get new gamers. And I think that longevity to a game can only be achieved if you keep the support going. Because otherwise people see it and then say, yeah, I'll get into it in a year or so, and it drops off the radar. They don't see it again. They don't think of it again. They don't get into it. So I think to keep it going, you do need that community. It helps, I think, Burrows and Badgers because it's such a niche kind of product. I think if you were just doing like something that was early Imperial Romans or Napoleonics or something like that, there's so many options out there that it's difficult to build a community around that. I think when you've got a niche product, people either like it or they absolutely, I mean, we've got people who absolutely hate it. There are people who look at the miniatures and are just horrified by the idea of anthropomorphic animal miniatures. We've had people look at it at Salute and just recoil in horror. But the people who like it really like it. So I think that helps. And you just use that to try and keep a community happy and vibrant and alive. And that keeps your game going.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as the old saying goes, if you're for everyone, you're for no one. Like, probably the reason you've got such passionate fans is because you're, of course, by contrast, going to have a few folk that it's not for them, and that's absolutely fine, isn't it?
Yep, that's it. Absolutely, we all like different stuff. It's a nice broad hobby.
With the I'm just interested in the mental aspect of creating a game, and you know, I imagine a lot of that can take place away from the computer. Like when you're writing a game, it's probably not necessarily always I'm sitting in front of a Word document or whatever. What's the sort of synergy there between, you know, when you're creating the miniatures, you're very much working with your hands. And is that an opportunity to work through? Maybe there's a certain problem, a kink in the rules you're trying to iron out. Do you find yourself doing both at the same time, or is it something you maybe go for a walk? Or
yeah, no, it's always kind of ticking away in the background, I think. Not even just when I'm sculpting. I mean, you sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and you've had a eureka moment when you fixed a problem that you weren't mulling over. I think what I tend to do is write the rules and then ignore them for a few days, just let it sit in the back of my mind. And you do gradually think of things when you think, oh, hang on, that's really not going to work. You know, that thing I said in the movement rules is going to make charging impossible. And those kind of things, they come up in playtesting for sure. But the thing with playtesting is that they might or might not come up. It depends on how the person plays the game, because they're never going to do all the interactions. So you do need to take time to literally let it just kind of percolate through your mind and try and find out what all the various interactions, how the rules are going to play off against each other. And try. I mean, you never catch it all, but you catch as much of it as you can.
And I guess that ties back into what you were saying about like writing a first edition versus a second edition. Like when you're writing a first one, it's like the classic musician, like you've got all your life to write your first album, but when you're doing your second album, you know, you're very much, there's a deadline or whatever, so there must be that.
And it's the kind of thing you've got to watch out for as well, I think, in a second edition, is that you do change things. You've got to change things, otherwise it's not a new edition. But you also keep another stuff the same, and it's when you make those changes, you've got to watch for how that affects existing rules. Because one of the things we did was we changed the action system. In the existing game, you've got one action per character, and that action includes a move. So if you do an attack, you can move and hit someone. If you're going to shoot, you can move and shoot. And it also, what we've done in the new one is we've switched that out to two actions, and now move is an action. So if your character is going to move, he has to make a move action. Or if he wants to move twice, he can make two move actions. And it's a very basic change, but it then threw up complications with various skills, various spells that they all had in their description. They all referenced the way the actions used to work. So you've got to go through, look at all the equipment, look at all the skills, look at all the spells, and see how that interacts with the change you've just made. And you've got to do that every time you make a change. There's a lot of bookkeeping involved into in a second edition, but it's what you've got to do to improve the thing.
On the sculpting front, just curious, like, have you ever sculpted at any other scale? I mean, your miniatures are sort of that 28 to sort of 32.
Yeah, I've done all sorts. I've done 6mm. I've done 6 up to 120. I've done all, because I was freelance previously, so you just kind of take whatever works available. Did a lot of 6mm stuff, historical and sci-fi, a lot of 15mm. I did a lot of stuff for Scotia Grendel. All sorts of different scales, basically. Everything up to sort of 1/10 with animals and things like that.
Anything you've done that you just really didn't enjoy, that you had to kind of slog through?
Anything Napoleonic, basically. Doing Napoleonic sculpting is just a nightmare because people are so picky. They're like, you know, they want the uniforms to be exact. They know what the shoulder braiding looks like on someone from that company in that year. And it's and the problem is, a lot of the sculpting is things like Napoleonics because a lot of people like it.
Cool. It's been really good to chat, Michael. Anything that we've, any sort of ground we've not covered that you think it would be useful to chat about before we start getting wrapped up?
I'm easy. If you've got any more questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I think we've covered a lot of ground there. I've really enjoyed finding out more about the entire company from the miniatures to, you know, putting the game together as well. So tell us a wee bit more about, you know, where the listener could go and where they could pick up the new edition when it comes out as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully the new edition should be getting released at Salute. That's the plan. I think the official release date is a couple of weeks after that, but we should have it with us for Salute. We've been told we will anyway. So fingers crossed. After that, the game itself should be available pretty much anywhere you can get books, because you can get it through Osprey or through Waterstones or any places like various games companies will have it as well. Miniatures only from us, because we're not big enough for retail and distribution yet. I can do it, but I'd have to put the prices up, and I don't really want to do that. So miniatures is through oathsworn.net, or burrowsandbadgers.com, and that's where you get the stuff. Other than that, I would, if people use Facebook, I would say join the Burrows and Badgers Facebook group, because it's very good. It's always nice in there and people are very helpful.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.